Great. So, hi. So, supply chain attacks. So, we probably all remember SolarWinds or heard about SolarWinds back in 2020. Maybe put supply chain attacks on the radar of everybody, certainly myself. As and sort of revealed the potential impact of an attack like this that could have far-reaching consequences. Since then, there have been a number of other pretty sophisticated supply chain attacks, like XZ Utils recently, which was a very long-term package takeover attack. Something like 3CX, which was like an attack chain of supply chain attacks to compromise an end application. And then, just every day, we seemingly hear about more and more supply chain attacks coming out of various complexities. So this thing is here to stay. And so one of the things we're going to be talking about today is some strategies that Sebastian, my colleague, and I see all the time in our continuous monitoring of open source package ecosystems, strategies that these threat actors like to use, and basically, what do they want? How are they trying to get it? And then also make some recommendations for how people can protect themselves from this kind of attack. So my name is Ian Kretz. I'm a security researcher at Datadog, specializing in supply chain security.
So yeah, I'm Sebastián Obregoso. I work in Datadog for about a year and a half. I also work with Dian in supply chain and also in application security for another research topics.
Great. Okay. So just to kind of set the stage, right? So what is a supply chain attack? What is a software supply chain? So at a very high level, right, we have a simple software supply chain here. Basically, we have some developer who wants to deliver some code to some consumer on the other end. And so there's this kind of high level process of maintaining the source code, developing the source code, right, somewhere under version control. Then we go to build the source code in some build system, right? And when we do that, we're probably going to be pulling in some third-party dependencies to get involved in that process. And then finally, publishing the finished artifact somewhere, or the source code if it's like a library, right? In some way where the consumer can access it. And so basically, at each step of this pipeline, there's various kinds of attacks that can take place. So we can be compromising the integrity of the source code via a malicious PR, for example. We can mess with the build system or mess with the inputs or outputs. We could go after the package repository itself, maybe do an account takeover of the publisher, right? And then we can also try to get our compromised or malicious dependencies into that build process. In terms of what these threat actors are after, it's pretty simple. There's kind of three things we see a lot. Credential theft, so developers have access to a lot of attractive targets for these attackers, data or code, right? Very simply, so a lot of times we'll see them going after API keys or credentials like this. Resource misuse, so things like crypto miners. You install some package and it's got an embedded crypto miner, and so there you go. Or thirdly, something like SolarWinds. So it's a downstream compromise where some downstream client of a package is being targeted. Maybe the choice to use open source is more complicated than it might seem at first, security-wise. So we like to feel confident in our decision to do so, and so that's kind of what we'll be talking about here.
Okay, so detecting malicious packages with Guardo. We're going to explain a little bit on how we are using this CLI tool, which is a tool that we created in Datadog internally for scanning PyPI and NPM ecosystems. So basically, we take we use Guardog, which pulls data from the package published in PyPI or NPM, and this tool makes use of two kind of analyses. One called metadata analysis, which is basically the detection of some patterns present in the characteristics of the package itself. Imagine something like the registration email address of a maintainer, right? In this case, it can be used in a disposal email address, and that's this kind of detection. On the other hand, you make use of another type of detection called source code analysis, which under the hood we are using two tools. One is called Yara, which makes use of is very good for indicator for compromises, such as domains or IP addresses. For instance, in this case, we can use like this kind of detections in a YARA rule. Also, we are using SAMGREP, right? This is another kind of tool that detects kind of a semantic analysis for, and it's very good to detect like a kind of a behavioral patterns in the code, right? For imagine this, we are using it shines really well with the detection of, for example, execution of BASE64 payloads. So this sample execution of Guarddog, this tool, you can see those are the rules that detected in a real package in npm. One a couple of things to notice in of Guarddog is that it allows you to use JSON and Serif format outputs to do a more automated analysis on the outcome. And also, one thing to notice is that Guarddog, it doesn't like give you any a final decision if the package is malicious or not. One thing to notice is that it just raises the risks on the package. Okay, the actual decision has to be taken by an actual triager at the moment. So this is how we use internally Guarddog in Datadog. Basically, we implemented a set of auto crawlers basically crawling the repositories by API and npm. We roughly you can imagine we have like 300k for PyPI and 75k of PyPI. 300k of npm packages and 75k of PyPI packages a month, and then we scan these ones with Guarddog, and the findings that we were talking about are filtered then with a set of behavioral patterns and a combination of machine learning techniques. Okay, to have an idea, we're considering having like a 0.6% of suspicious or interesting enough packages to further the further analysis, which is the triage stage, is conducted by a human, right? And if confirmed, then the malicious package is uploaded to a public repository called malicious public dataset.
Great, thanks. So now we'll just kind of go through. We have four kind of common strategies we see these threat actors using, and we'll just kind of use some of these packages we've been finding with Guarddog to kind of support kind of the case we're making. So the first is to target popular packages to get at their developers. We were saying earlier developers are attractive targets for these attackers. So how do you get developers? You go after the packages they want to use. So basically, there's kind of two ways you can go about this. If you're the attacker, you can publish a new already malicious package, or you can seek to take over an existing package. The first case is very easy. You can just upload whatever you want, like NPM, say. But it's not a very efficient strategy because like 10K packages get uploaded to NPM every day, so nobody knows your package, right? So if you're an attacker, how do I get people to take notice of my package? And so the way they often do this is not very sophisticated, right? You just kind of try to affiliate the malicious package with some targeted package, usually by like a naming trick. So we see a lot of combo squatting, where if I'm targeting requests, I could do something like pi requests or something, or typo squatting, where the name of the malicious package is a typo of the targeted package. You can see like that. Not very sophisticated stuff. On the other hand, package takeover is a lot more lucrative because these packages already have developers that use them, but it's harder for the attacker. They have to perform some kind of compromise to get it to work. And so this could be like compromising the maintainer credentials, a malicious PR, other things like that. So if we go back to our architecture kind of overview, this could take place like anywhere, right, at any stage of the pipeline, depending on what the attacker is trying to do. So here we have an example that we found in the past year of a name squatting attack or a combo squatting attack. So on the left, we have a legitimate NPM package, and on the right, we have a malicious one from a threat actor we've called Tenacious Pungsan at Datadog. So it's a DPRK-affiliated threat actor, and we use like the national dog breed of the nation to like name the threat actor. So the Pungsan is a DPR, it's from dog from North Korea. So you can see very simply passport, passports.js. Otherwise, like if you look at the readmes, they're exactly the same, although like the graphic didn't load on the left. But you know, you just copy the code, backdoor it, and upload it with a similar name, right? Not very sophisticated. On the package takeover side, the stuff tends to be more interesting, right? There was, right at the end of 2024, there was a notable package takeover instance for this Python package called Ultralytics, where they were running like a vulnerable GitHub action on their repo. You can see in the pink box, like the branch name is used like unescaped in a shell command. And so this allowed an attacker to submit a malicious PR with a crafted branch name, which like ended up running a shell script in the context of the GitHub action. And so they were able to like exfiltrate the PyPI publish token and upload some malicious versions to PyPI. There's a great analysis of this attack at that blog post. And so like package takeover is complicated, but the name squatting stuff is very simple to avoid by just like doing the simple obvious checks. So our advice would be just to use some simple guardrails to minimize the consequences of simple mistakes like a typo. In our research in Q4, we found that at least 70% of the malicious packages we triaged were using some kind of name squatting or targeting some other package. So if you're an end user, if you're like a user of an open source package, just make sure you're spelling everything correctly, the simple, obvious solution. To get around package takeover, you could use version pinning. Don't use like just the latest version of the package in case something happens. And then if you're lucky enough to work like at a company who can do this for you or in some institution who would do this, use like an internal, not copy, but sort of an internal version of the package repository with verified artifacts to kind of only pull things from. You'll cut off a lot of these kinds of problems that way. Meanwhile, if like for the package repositories themselves, I think we would suggest like introducing some kind of moderated publishing. So simply like not allowing people to publish on typo squats of certainly prominent packages, but ideally all packages. Whether it's some kind of verification of like this code looks too similar to an existing package, like no. And then also, post-compromise, take those package names out of circulation and replace them with security placeholders so that people who didn't update their dependencies don't get reinfected.
Okay, now we're going to talk about the next strategy used by threat actors, which is called exploit developers via install time hooks. So install time hooks is a method that can be used in the packages like PyPI or NPM that trigger at install time, right? This is a very like visual way to exploit something. So how this actually works in the wild? I wanted to go over with an example. So let's say I'm an attacker and I publish two set of artifacts, one to NPM with a malicious payload, very visual, I don't know, with the install execution, and another like a sample repo into GitHub for doing whatever. This GitHub repo does have non-malicious behavior whatsoever. The only thing that it has is a dependency to the NPM package that was published before. Then the user, a legitimate user is lured into download the package, right? There are a number of ways how threat actors can achieve this. One of the favorite techniques implemented by DPRK threat actors is to use them as a job interview, right? Hey, I need you to do this job for me. You have to do this test it out. You have to download this code and execute it. Then, bam. This code is pulled from the NPM and triggered. So if you look at into the architecture diagram that was shown before, this attack goes over in the use of compromised dependency and use of compromised package parts. And in here we can see an example of how this self-deleted initial attack access vector was used by the threat actor stress function. In Datadog, we name the known threat actors. Pungsan in this occasion goes after the dog breed of the country that was the threat actor representing. And so we can see here that it's executing the reference JS file, which in this case downloads using a curl, downloads a DLL, uses the RunDLL32 binary to be a trusted binary execution of the DLL code that is downloading. This is a technique very used again by this threat actor. Another example from in this case from MPyPI, from the lapardexos package. In this case was from MUT 8694. MUT stands for miscellaneous unattributed thread. Basically, this is the way we name thread actors that are not belonging to a known or a nation state actor, but we can cluster the attacks into one specific cluster. So as you can see, he's overriding the installation process, and in the installation process, he's also using PowerShell to download a binary and execute it. This time was a stealer. So what can we do with this? Be wary of install time hooks, right? This sounds obvious, but it's thread actors often disguise this or cover this under like downstream attacks, like dependencies. So the attack is not so obvious, right? So one recommendation or mitigation we can say, first of all, 85% of the malicious packages we observed during Q4 were using this kind of attack. So this is important, right? For package maintainers, we can say limit the usage of install scripts as much as possible. We see times and times again that developers are like using the install time hooks for greetings. Hey, thank you for installing this package. I mean, okay, but there are other ways to achieve that, right? For end users, if possible, completely disable install script. For a PyPI, you can use wheels. This doesn't implement setup like installation scripts. But for NPM, it probably will break stuff. You can leverage on Gardo for that matter. Gardo is the tool we showed earlier. So for package repositories, warn, you can use, this package is using this. Probably not very helpful, but surely it can help in some cases. And also perform regular audits if packages are using this.
Okay, great. So the third thing we see a lot is the use of obfuscation to kind of hide what they're doing. So if you're a threat actor and you want to deliver malware via NPM, a problem you run into right away is that everybody can see the malware. So you need to hide it in some way. Speaking of NPM, like one thing we see a lot is the use of this obfuscator called obfuscator.io, which produces this garbled sort of looking text here at the bottom. What it does is it takes the input code and like replaces the variable names with like random ones. It removes the formatting, but then it also kind of packs the code in a certain way where it's getting unpacked at runtime and actually being executed. So it makes it difficult to read and difficult for static analysis to help you on. Fortunately, it's relatively easy to partially unobfuscate it or deobfuscate it, and so indeed, that sample we were just looking at, when you deobfuscate it, it deobfuscates to this in part. So this is two screenshots from an info stealer called Beavertail, which is a DPRK-associated info stealer. So, you know, on the left and right, we have a second stage being downloaded, and then on the right, we have some data exfiltration. So again, you'll need to be on the lookout if you're like the user of a package or if you're using a package to build something. Here's just another example of this. On the Python side, it tends to be a little different. So we see a lot of like decode or and execute patterns, so base64 or decompression or decryption or like character encoding stuff. And it just goes to the point that like ecosystems have their own kind of obfuscation tactics or techniques that people use. So the obvious recommendation is just say no to obfuscation. There's no good reason to distribute open source code that's intentionally difficult to read. So don't write it, don't use it, don't host it.
And the last strategy we're going to see is the minimized exposure by using a second stage payload. So this is an example of how the second stage payload is used. In case you are not aware, malicious actors are using this thing that is called second stage payload, which is deliver one small portion of like just a downloader of the real stuff. So you only have to deal, like for instance, in this case we're seeing the StressPunction example, which lures the victim to install the package as we discussed. It runs automatically the script and then downloads the DLL, and then runs it, right? The point here is that the DLL has the actual payload. The only thing that was like in the package was the link to download it, right? Again, in the architecture diagram, this goes into the used compromise dependency or used compromise package. Here we see an example of using PowerShell to download an stealer. Again, the malicious payload is hosted in GitHub, not in NPM nor PyPI. Another example using, again, obfuscation, the method that Ian was talking about, is concealing a bash script that installs a service to run a miner. So what can we do with this? Make sure your code is behaving, okay? How easier said than done, right? So for package maintainers, we can say avoid using external runtime downloads. It's harder. It's not always to do able to do this, but in several times we've seen that there is use, it's overly used, right? So for end users, examine if a package downloads has download patterns. Like, is again, this is harder to achieve, but Gardner can help out here. Otherwise, you can use a container to somehow mitigate the data exposure of the host. Else, you can try.
Yeah, so this thing called Supply Chain Firewall. So at the tail end of last year, we released this open source package that basically is just a drop-in CLI tool to like filter your NPM and PyPI install or pip install commands, excuse me. So it'll inspect the install targets. It'll check them against lists of known bad packages or like if there are vulnerabilities, it'll let you know about that too. And then, it'll kind of, if you set up your environment the right way, it'll passively scan all of your commands. So there's the pip install command if you like.
Okay, so final thoughts. For package maintainers, don't be shady. That means leave the bad guys do the weird stuff. Try to do like the most obviously benign code behavior, right? For end users, don't be an easy target. If you're installing something that you're unaware of what it is, do your research, check, test, probably isolate it, right? And for package repositories, lastly, increase the barrier to 20 for threat actors. It's really, really easy for threat actors to publish bogus or malicious packages. So there are a lot of good improvement opportunities there to prevent that for the techniques we saw today. And, yep, that is it.
We have 2 minutes for questions.
Yep.
So go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, thank you very much for the interesting talk. I have a question about the supply chain firewall. You said that it checks against a long list of malicious packages. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, malicious packages are removed from the official package repository. So, for example, on NPM, you have a security holding packages. Mm. So, I wanted to ask you, like, what is actually preventing the supply chain firewall if you're somehow already prevented from the actual package?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer is that's kind of it. It's the very early days for this tool. We hope to. I'm sorry. The question was. What if packages are being taken down quickly from these open source ecosystems, what is Supply Chain Firewall actually doing for you? So you're right. Right now, it's kind of only good for, on the malicious side, for things that are known to be malicious, right? So if it's been taken down, the threat has been kind of neutralized in some sense. These things can loiter around in different mirrors and things, maybe. It also consults osv.dev, so there's like a secondary function for pointing out vulnerabilities. We hope to integrate like scanning capabilities into the tool later on, maybe facilitated by GuardDog. That's where we are today.
We are out of time. Maybe one question.
Sorry.
Nice talk. You focus a lot on the package managers. Any thoughts about, for the supply chain, you also mentioned quickly the developer environment. Any thoughts about all the crazy plugins that are going on out there?
Sorry, come again.
You focus a lot on the supply chain and the package part, but almost nothing on the developer place. So do you have any thoughts about the plugins in the developer environment, like the Visual Studio Code plugins?
So If I understand correctly, if it's like we are focusing a lot of on the package maintainer, but if there is something we can do on the developer side. So so basically we are we're giving like a couple of good tips for every single part, right? For instance, in the for the developers, we said something about like try not to run or to provide obfuscated code, right? But this is like this is something like it has to be implemented. This control has to be implemented in all parts. Like we can say to this to the developer, hey, don't obfuscate your code. We can detect it. But if package maintainers or repositories are not preventing to upload to open source repositories obfuscated code, it's like that's pretty much everything we can do, right?
I think we're out of time, so thank you. Okay.
Thanks.
Yep.
Is that your cable?
Nope. Okay.